welcome to Take Two. Thank you so much for subscribing. Anna, how do you think our first stab at Take One went? What do you reckon?
Well, aside from the fact that you spoiled two different movies for me, Rufus, I think that went quite well.
It's what I do. Straight into an email. Hi, both. This is Zach Jacobson, by the way. Legatage listener. First time emailing to the new show. There was a brief mention in last week's Take Two around how one should refer to your carryover listeners from, dare we say it, previous iterations? Heritage or legacy? In keeping with themes of a theology nature, I propose we merge the words together and refer to us long-timers as heresy listeners. Zach, I love it. Dear Saga Cruz and Tom Cruise, that's very good. By the way, this is from Professor Lionel Tarasenko. You may recognise that name from Rubin College, Oxford. Hello. I'm a first-time emailer and relatively new convert, although my wife has been a member of the church for a long time. We often... I've just realised, by the way, that if we call ourselves heresy listeners, where does that leave the church?
They're heretics.
Yeah.
I'm into it.
Okay.
I'm a contrarian. I'm into everything that is counterculture or going against the system.
Okay. All right, John Lydon. Back to Rubin College, Oxford. We often listen to your podcast in the car on the way from Oxford to Christchurch at some length when stuck in traffic on the M27 or in the New Forest M27, bane of my life. Despite my Ukrainian name, my paternal grandfather was born in Kharkiv. I am 50% French through my mother, and I was brought up near Paris until the age of 13. I was horrified two podcasts ago to hear the so-called original title of Notre Dame on fire, given as Notre Dame Brûlée, as in creme brûlée, which would be translated as Notre Dame burnt or burnt Notre Dame. I was therefore delighted to hear during the last podcast before your cruise that one of your correspondents had put you right, but there is possibly more. I do not know whether Jean-Jacques Annaud, the director of Notre Dame on Fire, second Jean-Jacques Annaud shout-out, actually, because he directed Quest for Fire, has mentioned this, but it seems to me that the title of the film Notre Dame Brûlée is a nod to the 1966 film Paris Brûle-t-il, or in English, Is Paris Burning? Now, I'm going to interject, and that was a book on our bookshelves at home.
My
parents met during the student riots in Paris in 68.
Stop it.
And when I heard the title of this film, I have to say, I immediately thought of the spine of this book on our bookshelf, Is Paris Burning?
I want to see a movie about your parents meeting.
Honestly, it's incredible. they tell stories they courted. Okay, one fact. My dad was studying mime in Paris in 1968, met my mum, who was a translator for a blind French 80-year-old called Mimi, and they courted by sitting on a park bench every night with baguette and cheese.
Stop it.
And they watched the riots.
Stop it!
It's the most French thing.
I will give you £1 for your parents' life story.
I know. Perpetuity rights.
I would like to option this right now.
It's the most romantic story that none of us can possibly live up to. Anyway, back to the email. This film is Paris Burning, which stars not only Jean-Paul Belmondo and Alain Delon, two icons of French cinema, but also Orson Welles and Kirk Douglas, tells the story of the liberation of Paris during the Second World War in 1944. Hitler wanted Paris destroyed and burned to the ground as the Nazi troops retreated. But thank God, the military governor of Paris, General Dietrich von Choltitz, refused to carry out the orders. If he had not, Notre Dame, the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre and other monuments would have been set on fire. At the end of the film, there's a voice on the phone repeatedly asking, Paris brûle-t-il? Is Paris burning? The answer could, of course, have been Notre Dame brûle, La Tour Eiffel brûle, etc. But what was avoided in 1944 finally came to pass for Notre Dame in 2019. I hope that the cruise afforded you both plenty of rest and that mention of this potential link between two French films 56 years apart may have piqued your interest. Keep up the good work and let's keep the blue and yellow flag flying. Professor Lionel Tarasenko of Rubin College, Oxford. Professor, that was really interesting. Thank you.
That was doubly interesting with the story of your parents meeting.
I'll tell you one more. Dad Morsel, where I alluded in Take One, he worked on the Jean-Jacques Annaud film Quest for Fire, which is a very cult film about cavemen.
Yes, starring Ron Perlman as a caveman, which I watched so many times as a child.
Ray Dornchong. And Giant Haystacks, the British wrestler, and Adrian Street, the British wrestler. It was a weird mix of Hollywood and tea time British wrestlers from the Wolverhampton scene of around 1980. My dad got off the plane in Nairobi and was presented with a goodie bag from Paramount Studios. And they all opened it, and it was an enormous bag of...
Stop it.
Yeah! It doesn't happen anymore! Oh, come on, 1980s Hollywood. He was also in the middle of a stampede of elephants.
You cannot drop these things and expect me not to ask questions.
We'll do a spoiler special. How can it be anything else coming from me on Quest for Fire in, I don't know, take four? Does it even exist? Let us move on now to One Frame Back. This is where we explore films that are connected in some way to one of this week's releases. This week, we're recommending alien movies inspired by, of course, Nope. We've got some good recommendations by people on Twitter. But Anna, can you quickly summarize Nope for those who might have missed it?
So Nope stars Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer as sibling Hollywood horse trainers who are a little bit down in the luck. Their dad has just passed away under mysterious circumstances where something fell out of the sky and killed him instantly. And they're just trying to make ends meet when they notice that there is literally a flying saucer hiding behind a cloud up in the sky above their farm. And I don't want to say anything else. Strange and fabulous things happen, and they deal with those things in surprising ways.
So, Twitter recommendations for alien movies. Fargo Boyle says, outside of the obvious, Alien, Star Wars, E.T., there is the mad satire of Starship Troopers. Oh, yeah, love it. The paranoia of The Thing, the time-bending Arrival. These are all good. The cat food-eating inhabitants of District 9. What a film. Yeah. And the ever-decreasing odds of reaching Shell Beach in Dark City.
Oh, I'm glad Dark City got a mention. Oh, that's a goodie.
I vividly remember seeing that in the late 90s. It stayed with me. Craig says, I really enjoyed Another Earth by Mike Cahill and Britt Marling.
I love Another Earth. It's Britt Marling has her own brand of sort of existential millennial sci-fi, which I am very on board with. She's great. Her series, The OA, which actually stars Brandon Pereira.
And hello to Jason Isaacs.
In one of the breakout roles there. It's available on Netflix. It got cancelled after a couple seasons.
Very controversially, because it's many people's favorite.
It's not really an alien series, but it is sort of vaguely sci-fi-ish.
Incredible.
And it's incredible.
Craig continues, it left me pondering the other versions of me on another Earth, making all the right decisions where I chose wrong on this spinning rock. Nicely written, Craig. Daniel Smith says, Arrival, Contact. Can I say Highlander? It only qualifies if we acknowledge Highlander 2, which I am very reluctant to do. Chris says, other than Alien and Aliens, E.T., District 9, and Lilo and Stitch. Touché, Chris. Underrated, The Faculty, mostly forgotten.
Yes.
The Hidden with
Kyle MacLachlan. Mostly forgotten by who? Excuse you.
Well, certainly not Chris or you. So, Anna, what is your choice for this week's One Frame Back, and where can people watch it?
Oh, God, can I just pick one?
Go on. Yeah, just one.
Well, I don't
have
one.
No, you know what?
I don't have one. I'm a chronic overachiever.
Go for leather, two or three.
I've got five.
Okay. Mine don't have time for five.
So, I wanted to shout out The Faculty, really written by Kevin Williamson.
Great,
epic 90s cast and great twist ending. Close Encounters of the Third Kind from 77, a Steven Spielberg film, which I think is probably the closest one in tone to Nope.
Agreed.
I would say. I'd like to shout out Stargate with my own personal supernova, James Spader.
Spader.
Love a bit of Spader.
Come on.
Love The Thing. But also this Amazon Prime little indie sci-fi that kind of blew up a bit on the internet a few years ago called Vast of the Night.
Yeah, man.
It's from 2019. It's very recent. It's very talky. It's got a very big Orson Welles radio play energy.
Mercury Theater vibe,
fascinating. Really intriguing to
watch. I love that film. I kept expecting the aliens to come. Don't spoil it for people who haven't seen it.
It's happening again.
I'm sorry.
You're doing it just to spite me.
Vast of Night. totally recommended.
And can I just say...
What?
People should go back and watch The Twilight Zone. The original Rod Sterling Twilight Zone. If it's good enough for Jordan Peele, it's good enough for us.
William Shatner on the plane?
Yes. Iconic.
Come on.
Not the film, the show. The original 50s show.
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Yeah. I'll buy that for a dollar. Shall we have some more Jordan Peele?
We can always have a bit of Jordan Peele.
I can't tell you what a thrill it was to talk to him. And let's roll more Jordan Peele. So I'm back with Jordan Peele for take two. Thank you for giving us the extra time, Mr. Peele. I should say, for transparency, I have been working recently with your comedy wife, Keegan-Michael Key.
So what have you guys been doing now?
Well, my day job is an actor, and I was doing Wonka with him about 6 months ago.
Fantastic.
And we were talking about Key and Peele, which is known in this country amidst kind of comedy circles. And, you know, everyone I know obsesses over it. And I wondered whether all the sketch writing muscles that you must have developed over the years working with Keegan, whether that feels like a kind of different industry to something like Nope, or are you constantly using lessons that you learned writing sketch on a bigger sort of canvas like this film?
I mean, it definitely, yeah, Key and Peele for me was like the 10,000 hours of understanding how to entertain moment to moment, I would say. And it's also a great lesson in the value of a good idea versus an okay idea, and the value of execution versus, you know, good execution. So yeah, I did learn a ton. And when I'm writing, I feel like I can feel sort of freed that I can turn off the muscle to push for the laugh. Mm. Because I know that can have, you just can't push.
It can be a tyranny, can't it?
Yeah, it can get out of hand. It's a slippery slope. But yeah, it's all connected.
I wanted to give a shout out to Michael Wincott in this film, who I recognized from 100 things. And there was a very specific role that I suddenly remembered him from, which was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Where he says that line about the carvers.
Right.
So somebody's carving us a heart out of a spoon.
And it ain't Alan Rickman. Wincott is one of the most evil characters. And I always wondered, whatever happened to that British guy? Because, you know, coming from here, you think you know everyone who does a kind of deep, malevolent accent. Mm-hmm. Turns out he's Canadian. And 30 years later, he's delivering a tremendous performance in your film. Had you worked with Michael before?
I never had. I have always wanted to. And when I was younger and sort of dreaming of being a filmmaker, I was like, you know, that's the guy. You know, they always cast like a Bruce Willis, but Michael Wincott, like, what about him? Like, he always gets the villain. This guy should be a hero too.
Right.
Anyway, so that was in the back of my mind. I gave him a call when I was writing the script. And we connected, and he's a great human, a fantastic actor. He gave it everything.
Oh, it's beautiful. He plays this kind of Peckinpah-ish kind of DOP, sort of maverick. But you have Hoyte van Hoytema, who I imagine is probably not the tyrannical DOP that Michael's playing. Can you talk about Hoyte, who, if people don't know, he's done Dunkirk, he did Let the Right One In. He's done every visually spectacular film of the last 10 years. What was that like working with him?
It's like if you're in a role-playing game or a video game and you acquire a partner who is like an expert at tinkering magic.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you've unlocked this new world of tools to play with. It's just so, and he's this wonderful guy. He's really funny. And he's just the perfect guy to go ambitious with. So I gave him a script that was impossible. You know, the nights in this film are impossible to shoot. And any other cinematographer in the world would tell you that.
Jordan, it's been a real treat to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. This has been real great.
Jordan Peele. Can never get me enough Jordan Peele.
I would watch 10,000 hours of Jordan Peele content.
You know what's so lovely about him, and hopefully it comes through, is that he is, aside from being, you know, one of the most incredible filmmakers, with the best opening three films since Rob Reiner, I'm going to say.
I mean,
he's a fan. He's a fan of cinema.
He's a nerd.
And he talks about his films and the act of filmmaking. as someone reading, you know, Empire or listening to this podcast. His enthusiasm, I just find really infectious.
But also he's enthusiastic about audiences.
Right.
He respects audiences and he wants to deliver a good show and entertaining film, but also something that will leave people questioning things. You know, it's the thing I was talking about in my review, is the fact that he loves to leave audiences with questions that are unanswered.
That's it. I'm not even going to answer that.
Also, shout out to the question about Michael Wincott. I really appreciated that because the minute he comes on screen as the character with the best name, Antlers Horst. Yes, a very surly and pretentious cinematographer. It's that voice. He's the villain of the 90s. I remember him as the villain in The Mask and
right.
the villain in The Crow.
Oh.
And then when you mentioned Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah.
I want to carve. I'm going to carve your face up with a spoon.
There you go.
Not you.
Not me. Why not me?
Well, if you spoil another film for me, you know, maybe.
Yeah. Just fishing into the cutlery drawer as we speak. Thank you, everyone, for subscribing. Next week, Rhianna Dillon and Robbie Collin are here, since Mark and Simon will still be on their cruise. But thank you for having us. Hello there, Vanguard. Welcome to some more cruise dispatches. Though listening to those horns, that's official code. You know, that amount of blasts on a horn isn't just a, hi, we're here. I think that means something like, send a vet, the camel is poorly, or something like that. But anyway.
So send a vet, the camel is poorly.
I think that's what it meant.
That's the plot of Ishtar, isn't it?
Anyway, so we're having a good cruise this year. There was a little kerfuffle last evening at the captain's table when Lynn Ramsey suggested that Celine Siamar's My Life as a Courgette was superior to Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yeah, she made a category. They're different genres of films.
And fortunately, we were able to explain that through mime, essentially, and blancmange.
And modern dance.
Anyway, here we are, blue skies, somewhere off the coast of wherever. And we've taken some time away from Bridge with Stanley Tucci and Margot Martindale to bring you some extra premium content. Haven't we, Mark?
We have. It is a new feature.
It's super premium. It's very, very exclusive. It's called Five Films to See Before You Die and One Afterwards, meaning you get, incredibly, six choices, as the last one is the film that you'd see in heaven.
Now, I have to say that when Simon Poole came up with this, I took what he said quite literally.
Right.
So I've chosen, you know, five to see before you die and then one after you die.
Yes.
Which isn't number one. It's I just took what he... I mean, I'm very literal. I'm like Ron Burgundy.
So, but what's the difference? I don't understand.
Because I think the suggestion from what he was saying is that the one you'd see in heaven is the very best, the pinnacle. But it's not. I did top five and then a sideways glance one.
Okay, so that once you
died... Sense?
So, I mean, yeah, so you're dead and now there's...
And now we'll run this.
Okay. So for the very first... FFSBYD, let's just call it FFS. It's the films of David Lynch. Mark, you give us at most 40 seconds on David Lynch, and then we'll hear some suggestions from the unfortunate folk back at home who didn't make it onto the cruise.
David Lynch, once described famously as Jimmy Stewart from Mars, the definitive surrealist, populist film, these films. As for the films themselves, I will cite one brilliant moment, which you can find on the internet. If you just look up David Lynch owns Mark Kermode, I ask David Lynch a question that lasts the best part of 3 minutes.
I can't believe that.
To which his answer is pause, followed by a comically, beautifully timed no.
Excellent. I might just look that up. Okay, so correspondence here. Duncan P says, The Straight Story, it was an unexpected departure for Lynch. Simple, nuanced and understated piece of filmmaking, so full of empathy and heart, just perfect.
Forrest Gump on a tractor.
Rob says, The Blue Velvet for me, I love both the more straightforward Lynch and the truly eccentric, but Blue Velvet is the perfect middle ground, mainstream enough to work whatever your mood, weird enough to stay ever present in the mind. Arcane Strain says, Fire Walk With Me, an underrated masterpiece, I adore it. Wintermute says it has to be Mulholland Drive, fantastic central performances and some of the most terrifying and breathtaking sequences ever put on film.
Ren Sark says, Mulholland Drive, beautiful, profound, mysterious, romantic, and deeply frightening all at once. Zhuflu says, I'll cheat and say Twin Peaks, The Return, Episode 8.
Two things to add there. Firstly, it's not really a cheat because Sight and Sound did have that as their best movie of the year, although it is a television production. And obviously, as everybody knows, Mulholland Drive was the one when they did the poll of best films of this century. Mulholland Drive was the thing that came out on top. And of course, that actually started life as a TV film.
So, take it away for FFS, your five David Lynch films to see before you die and one afterwards.
Okay, so at number five, Lost Highway, which is a 97 bifurcated narrative described by David Lynch as a psychic fugue, in which it's a film in which the lead character halfway through changes into someone else. And my best memory of this is I went to Paris to interview David Lynch about it. It was the first time I'd met him. And he told me this wonderful story, which is that the night before, two nights before, the film had been screened in the glitzy cinema in Paris where it had its premiere, and they had screened the reels in the wrong order. Oh. And as David Lynch himself said, it got the best reviews that it got anywhere in the world when it was screened in all the wrong order. And I think in many ways that perfectly sums up the magic of David Lynch. At number four, Blue Velvet. The first time I saw Blue Velvet, I walked out of it in outrage. The second time I saw it, some years later, I thought it was a masterpiece. And it's interesting that somebody said it's mainstream enough to enjoy, because this is a new definition of the word mainstream that I hadn't previously encountered. What Blue Velvet taught me is that you can love films and you can hate films, but the films that are really important are the films that you love and hate at the same time. And I cannot watch Blue Velvet casually, which is why I thought the mainstream thing was kind of interesting, because Blue Velvet is a film that it's going to take you a while to recover from it. And it's dark and horrible and then weirdly funny and creepy. And yeah, and I love it and hate it at the same time. Number three, The Elephant Man, 1980. Extraordinary performance by John Hurt, who, incidentally, trivia fans, John Hurt told me when I interviewed him on stage in The Isle of Man that he made The Elephant Man in the gap between starting work on Michael Cimino's terrible Heaven's Gate and finishing work on Michael Cimino's terrible Heaven's Gate. In the middle of it, he made The Elephant Man. Extraordinary. It just looks beautiful. Beautifully shot by Freddie Francis. Financed by Brooks Films, of course. And Mel Brooks, who is the person who we must thank for The Elephant Man's existence. Featuring standout turns from a cast which includes a very young Dexter Fletcher and an older Freddie Jones, of course, Toby Jones' father.
And Anthony Hopkins.
And Sir Anthony Hopkins, who apparently, during the making of the film, according to John Hurt, at one point when David Lynch, because David Lynch was kind of a fish out of water because he was in the UK doing it, and David Lynch would stand by the camera and he would talk like this and he would go like this. And at one point, according to John Hurt, Anthony Hopkins said, "What are you saying? No one can hear you. Speak up."
Excellent. Good old Sir Anthony.
Good old Sir Anthony. At number three, Eraserhead, a plot that can only be summarised by, I think, the movie's tagline, which was a dream of dark and troubling things. I think it's perhaps the most perfect expression of nightmarish logic. Made over a period of, I think, 4 or 5 years, Lynch was doing a paper round in order to finance it. They'd shoot all the way through the night and then he'd go off and do a paper round. Extraordinary central performance by Jack Nance, who of course became Lynch's muse, spawned the greatest industrial soundtrack of all time. I mean, nice to send a Neubarton, have a listen to that. And particular plaudits to the great Alan Splett, who was the sound engineer, who, when I interviewed Lynch, which I have done several times, as you probably noticed, in his home in Los Angeles, he showed me his audio mixing console, into the plinth of which are placed some of Alan Splett's ashes, so that when David Lynch sits at the recording console to mix the film, the spirit of Alan Splett vibrates up from the floor and fills him, because he continues to be his great inspiration for sound. But at number one, and partly I think because it was the least understood, most rejected of Lynch's films, Fire Walk With Me, because Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me was a film that was only understood by horror fans. It is the most perfect explanation of an audience's and critics completely misreading what the film that begins with a television set being smashed, incidentally, was about. the most famously snarky review in Twin Peaks, nothing is what it seems, this isn't the worst film ever made, it just seems like it, is exactly, and I say this as a critic who's succumbed to this himself, a perfect example of a critic with a snarky line sticking by it because it sounds good, but it's completely untrue. One of the greatest soundtracks of all time, Angelo Badalamenti, and I was very honoured to have been asked to write the sleeve notes for the vinyl release, which I did do. Cheryl Lee should have got an Oscar nomination. As it was, the film just got absolutely toilet canned, and only later did people come round to realising that it is the greatest horror film of the year, one of the greatest horror films of its period, and I think the most perfect explanation of how Lynch can be savagely misunderstood. I love that film. And then the one to see when you're dead.
Yes.
Because it's the best way of watching it. Dune, the original 1984 compromised, messed up, botched 1984 version of Dune, because what the actual fruitcake. I mean, you just watch that. Watching Dune is like watching Caligula. You just go, what on earth is going on?
So do you think once you're dead, you might understand what's going on?
Maybe.
Maybe it'll make sense.
Maybe. I mean, Lynch himself has sort of distanced himself from any attempt to reconstruct the film in, longer director's cuts. And we all know that it was savagely compromised. But I mean, he did it because there was other films that he wanted to get made. And, of course, he famously turned down a Star Wars film. But this, George Lucas called him in to ask him about, I think it was filming Return of the Jedi, and he said he arrived at Lucas's house, and he said the minute he got there, he just had a headache, and then Lucas was showing him all the toys of the game, and he just had to leave because he just couldn't deal with it. But he made Dune, and it's just, what on earth is going on? So I think that's the taking Simon Paul literally as five films to see before you die and one to see
one
afterwards.
And one afterwards, okay. Which one shall we show on our open-air deck screening tonight? Family audience.
If it's a family audience, the straight story, because it is Forrest Gump we'll on
that.
A tractor.
Okay, we'll do that. If you could come by 6:30 and bring your own refreshments and nibbles, thank you very much. We're going to do five films to see before you die and then one afterwards for Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, okay, great.
Also Jane Campion.
Great.
So people can start thinking about those. There's some top recommendations coming up for
Terrific.
Our other cruise dispatches.
Very good.
Which is like a high-grade version of From Our Own Correspondent. And yet somehow...
But with more sound effects.
But with more sound effects, yes, and a top script. Anyway, thank you. That's quite enough of this.